Hi, this is Tony speaking to you. Oh, it's working. Amazing. This is my show. Starts at 5. By the way, you are welcome to hang around and watch for a bit if you want. You can go home, you know. We do a 2-hour weekly current affairs show from 5 till 7 every Friday.
Yeah, I need to be back, so I will.
Thank you anyway. You can, of course, listen in the car on the way home if you feel that desperate.
If you tell me the wave band.
93.2. We're in between Radio 3 and Radio 4. Which is actually quite a good place to be on the wavelet thing, because people, anybody who's pretty switched on is going to be flicking between those two stations. Right, let's get going. Now, could I just ask you to introduce yourself and tell us what your job was?
Yeah, I'm Michael Wren. I'm a former sub-editor. For quite a few years I was deputy editor of The Guardian Weekly. I'm now freelancing since a somewhat enforced retirement a couple of years ago from the Western Daily Press and the Evening Post in Bristol.
So tell us, what is a sub-editor?
Well, the sub-editor is the he's kind of the midpoint man, or woman, of course, between the writer and the paper appearing on the streets. Basically, he's responsible for everything that goes into the paper, apart from the original words, although quite often he might change a few of those that appear before him. So he's responsible for the headlines that go on the story, the stand first, the introductions, usually.
The stand first, what's that? That's something that a lot of people don't necessarily know.
The stand first, basically a part, an explanatory part that tells you what the story's about.
And a
some papers use them.
A par is a paragraph, you see, because there's quite a lot of jargon.
I may use technical terms. Yeah, a par is a paragraph. Stories are referred to as copy. Why? Probably back in the midst of times when the lots of copies had to be done of the story, but it was always called copy. And
as a sub-editor, as you were just saying there, you do sometimes have to actually change the words, maybe add a headline or change a headline, change some of that. That's quite controversial, isn't it? Because some journalists might not be all that pleased about their words being changed around, and of course there is the possibility that actually what you're doing there could potentially at least change the sense of what's been written.
Oh, quite often you're asked by an editor to completely change the sense of a story for various reasons, maybe legal reasons, maybe he doesn't like the slant the reporter's put on it, or it could be far too long, it needs totally rewriting to get it into the space you've allotted, and you're trying to do justice to the reporter by condensing the facts and making a silk purse out of a sow's ear on some occasions.
So what was the relationship like with your editors? Because that must be a little bit frosty sometimes. Have someone leaning over your shoulder saying, right, now I want you to do this and do that.
I think this kind of scenario is probably more what you would imagine, you might imagine through watching films about journalism. It's often, most of the time, it's not like that. Basically, you need to move copy quickly and get it into a format where it can be put into the page and the paper produced. Quite often, there's not really that much time for you and the editor to worry about the finer points. It obviously depends on which paper you're working for. If you're working for the Daily Mirror or the Sun, where you've got very, very few words, every word counts, and the editor takes much more of an interest in each paragraph. If you're working on a paper where a broadsheet paper or a paper, a serious paper like the Guardian, Telegraph, you've got much more space to fill, and the editor's got enough worries without hovering over you all the time. He just presumes you're a professional and you know what you're doing and you can be allowed to get on with it.
Now, how did you first get interested in the industry and in journalism? And, you know, how did you get your first job?
Well, this is a strange tale because actually, not so much journalism, but certainly the press was a family trade. And this wasn't uncommon. I grew up in Manchester. Manchester had a huge newspaper industry up until the 1960s, 1970s. It's now largely forgotten, but every national newspaper had a duplicate operation in Manchester. All the pages were produced in two centres, Manchester and London. The paper was assembled in two centres and printed on presses in Manchester, because Manchester had to distribute papers into Scotland, into Ireland, throughout the northeast, the northwest, down as far south as the Potteries, the North Midlands, and it was a complete newspaper production centre. In fact, The Guardian, of course, was originally the Manchester Guardian and was produced solely in Manchester up until about 1961, when it opened a printing in London. So Manchester had, I remember there, when I joined, there were over, the Manchester branch of the National Union of Journalists had over 2,000 members. I mean, you're talking a big industry here, and I remember how when I used to go and see my sister who lived out at Stretford, used to get the bus on Saturday night, my mum and I, because my father worked on the papers, he was a printer on the Daily Mail, and I remember coming back down Oxford Road, opposite where the BBC is now. Except I think the BBC's moved out to Salford, hasn't it, to the new media centre. But anyway, where the BBC was, were the offices of Odham's Press, and you could actually look down from the top deck of the bus into the production room of the Daily Herald, and the Daily Herald was being produced, and you could see compositors, you could see the floor flooded with lights, and you could see people rushing around with great trays of metal, and lots of people looking very busy. And I used to think, that's interesting, what's going on there? That's really exciting. Everybody seems to be busy. I'd have a look, see what goes on there. And there were probably half a dozen production centres in Manchester like that. There was the famous Daily Express building on Great Ancoat Street, which the famous Black Lubyanka, where you could actually see the presses rolling. The presses were on view behind great glass windows, and when the presses started roaring, you know, it shook the street. And then you had the Daily Mail on Northcliffe House on Deansgate. You had the huge what was originally the Kemsley House on Shude Hill, later became Thompson House, when the Kemsley Empire was bought out by the Thompson family, and later still it became Maxwell House, nothing to do with the coffee, but Captain Bob Maxwell of Daily Mirror fame. He took over that place, and now I believe it's called something like, I think it's the Print Works, and it's actually they kept the facade, and it's a group of nightclubs and all kinds of amusements, and completely different to how I remember it when it was actually a newspaper production factory.
So what was your first job?
Well, my first job, I worked on a weekly paper in Stockport, the Stockport Express, which was owned by the Thompson organisation. And basically, I left school at 18, I got A-levels, I got three A-levels, and I decided that I wanted to work in newspapers, and I thought, as I had a reasonable literary bent, that I'd try writing rather than producing them. on the press. So I wrote to a few local newspaper editors. It all sounds very, very al fresco, this. And a couple of days later, I got a visit from a guy who was already a reporter on the Stockport Express. I was actually going to working on a forklift truck. And I'd come home at lunchtime, and he said, the editor's quite interested in your letter. He's got a vacancy. How would you like to come in and see him? So I said, fine. Came in a couple of days, got on well with him, and next week I started work. I mean, I realise that this must sound very, very strange to people these days who decide on a career in media and spend years working towards it, but I mean, that's what it was like. I know I went to a grammar school, quite a good standard grammar school in Manchester, Catholic grammar school, and I think in my year I was the only person I know of who went into the media. It was not a particularly popular career. There was not much certainty about it, not much career structure, and it just wasn't terribly popular with people. Now it seems to be incredibly popular. Everybody wants to do it. But it certainly wasn't like that when the rest of my family kind of scratched their heads and thought, on earth would you want to be a reporter on the newspapers? Lots of jobs you could do which pay better and be much more, give him a better career path. Still, if he wants to do it, well, see.
Now, you mentioned the compositors earlier. Now, that's a craft which is just completely disappeared from the industry now. Can you give us an idea of how the compositors and the editorial staff used to actually produce the newspaper in those days?
Well, they used to produce it in very, very close proximity to each other. One of the good things about how newspapers were produced in the past was that all these trades, I think of journalism as a trade, really, we were all in the same place. We were all working together. Compositors, stereotypers, readers. Yes, readers. I'm not talking about the people who bought the paper. I'm talking about people whose job it was to actually read words which had been set, the reporter's words which had been come out from the sub-editors and been set into type. They had to read them and they had to supposed to correct the literals. And so we all went to the same pubs, we all let in the same canteen, and it was very much we all felt like we were singing from the same hymn sheet, and that was a good thing about it. There was a real sense of community working on newspapers.
So what did a compositor actually do, and what about a stereotyper?
This takes you back into the, you know, how far back can you go? Gutenberg Press. Basically, if you want to turn words into type, you need to go through, before the advent of digital publishing, when everything changed, they had to be produced into metal type. Metal type, an impression had to be made of the metal type. From that impression, a printing plate had to be produced, which was bolted onto the press. So there were several stages. If you think about it, when a reporter, stop me if I get too technical, but basically, when you type your words on the typewriter onto a sheet, it goes to the sub-editor. The sub-editor then, when he's made his checks, he's put his headlines on it, he's made his alterations, gave it to a compositor. The compositor was sitting in front of a machine called the linotype machine, which was a great huge clanking thing. It was being invented in about the middle of the 19th century, and basically produced lines of type in molten lead, or at least a lead alloy. These were assembled, these lines of type, onto a thing called a chase. They were then slotted into a great metal enclosure. Sorry, that was the chase, which made up the page. The pictures were made using a time-honored process involving etchings and acid, and the whole thing was bolted together. An impression was taken of it in a material rather like papier-mâché, if you can imagine it, and then this was put into a further machine called a stereotyping machine, and molten lead was again injected into this machine to make a semicircular plate which was bolted on the press. It was an amazingly complex and dirty, noisy, smelly operation. How it ever used to get papers out every night in the time we did, I sometimes wonder, but basically everybody knew their job and we all got on with it.
Now, one of the peculiar things is that we've now got quite a different system with the advent of new technology, desktop publishing, and yet for some reason the journalists are told often, in fact in most of the national newspapers by the editors, that they actually need their stories, their copy in before the old deadlines used to be with this incredibly sort of manual, cumbersome process. Now, any idea why that this, might be?
Yes, this has nothing to do with the desktop publishing. The to produce a paper from desktop publishing operation can be a very, very quick operation. This is simply economics. When I was started, you used to have armies of people working late into the night and even into the next morning to get those papers out and get them on the trains. Today you have far, far fewer people producing newspapers, certainly at the production end, and the presses, far fewer people on the presses engaged in press work. You've got fewer lorry drivers or the truck. When I started, all the papers went by train. They didn't go by lorry, or just local deliveries that go by lorry. They all went on special newspaper trains. The whole industry has just completely changed. It's economics. It's simply not profitable to have armies of people working late into the night on this kind of operation. They could produce them much, much later and get them to your door, but it would cost an absolute fortune, and it's just not feasible.
Now, one of the other things is the Manchester Guardian, which you were working on as well, it was a regional-based national newspaper. Now, that's quite a rarity, isn't it?
Indeed, it was. It was. I must confess, I joined about 69. It had been called the Guardian from the mid-60s, but it was still produced wholly in Manchester and wholly again in London, as all the other nationalists were. But yes, it was unique in that it was a regional newspaper which was produced nationally. For a time it looks as though the Yorkshire Post might go that way, because the Yorkshire Post was a very highly respected newspaper, possibly never quite in the Guardian's league, but certainly for a time there was a thought that the Yorkshire Post would become a national paper. But I think the Guardian's pretty unique in what it managed to achieve.
What do you think of the fact that almost everything, really, national and international news in Britain is produced from London now, because there's nothing really like that? And it's one of the reasons I think maybe that the Guardian did quite well, is that it had a perspective which wasn't necessarily rooted in the London Fleet Street as it was then hub. So what do you think about that?
Well, I'm sure that was true. I agree with you, Tony. Alas, I don't think that's true anymore. In fact, in many ways, the Guardian is the most metropolitan of papers now. I don't know. The world has changed so much that it's hard to see any regional newspaper ever becoming national in that way. It just wouldn't happen like that. I mean, there's even talk that I've even heard the Guardian, I think the editor of the Guardian, Musbridge, say a few years ago, he envisaged that in future the Guardian would be just distributed digitally. The costs in producing and distributing newspapers are so huge now that digital production makes a lot of sense. I mean, I've even heard suggested, why don't we just send newspapers digitally and give people cheap printing machines, let them print their own newspapers if they want, or just those stories they want to read. It makes a lot more sense economically than shifting masses of newsprint around the country. I mean, when you think about it, you buy a large, you know, a Telegraph or a Guardian or a Times, and how much of it do you, of those maybe 96 pages or how many do you actually read? Maybe about a third of them. The others you may skip. Some you probably don't look at at all. So, I mean, this is just wasted effort, wasted paper. So, although I'm still a big fan of the printed word, and I'm a big fan of the new independent I, which is being distributed at 20p, I don't know if you realise that the I is produced in Oldham. On the Mirror's presses, they don't make much of a fuss about that, but it is, even the ones you get down in Bristol.
Now, with all the changes that there've been over the years, and you've just been talking about quite a lot of, you know, the economic side of it, the production side of it, the technology side of it, do you think this has really affected the feel of the newspaper and the content of a newspaper at all, or is it really still pretty much the same as it was being produced in the 1960s?
Well, my impression, I can tell you, for the 15 years I have been working in Bristol on the Western Daily Press, and latterly on the Press and the Evening Post combined, I didn't feel, certainly for the last 5 years, that there was a great deal of love and attention went into the production of these papers, certainly on the Post. I never had as much affection for it as I did for the Western Daily Press, and I think this largely stemmed from the hands-off approach of the editors in that time. They more and more became people who were sent down from head office with a financial plan in mind that they had to execute, and their interest and attention that they gave to individual stories was far less, or certainly in my latter days of my employment, almost non-existent. One never learned what the editor thought about any part of the paper. I don't have very favourable recollections of that.
Now, what about how the newspaper actually gets its stories? Because you know, we've got there's two really completely separate sides to that. One is the press releases coming in, which are usually from commercial organisations saying, "Hey, this is important, print this." And the other thing is the more proactive side of the newspaper, and an editor will actually send a reporter out and say, "Go and find this story." Have you noticed much change in the way that that balance has shifted at all over the years?
Oh, absolutely. Quite often press releases that come from commercial organisations or public bodies just go in more or less unaltered, and it's largely a question of, you know, the amount of the number of people that the paper has to produce these stories. If you send somebody out on a story, he could quite well be gone all afternoon or all morning and come back with one story. If he's sitting in the office, and you can phone up a couple of people and knock out a couple of press releases, do a bit of copying and pasting off the web, he can turn out many more stories in that time. So it's simple economics.
What about the whole role of competition? Because in Bristol, all of the newspapers, including the Venue magazine, are produced by Northcliffe. Do you think that that's had an effect on the actual content? Because, well, you know, in somewhere like Stroud, for example, you've got NewsQuest have a newspaper, the Stroud News and Journal, and Northcliffe have got their, I think it's called Stroud Life. And actually, when you go to Stroud, you see there's a lot more real, you know, sort of proactive news in those papers because of the competition. Now, how does that affect things in Bristol, do you think?
I'm sure what you're saying is true. I think competition would be excellent. But, you know, again, we're back to economics and the expense of producing a newspaper. I mean, I would think you'd have much more chance of producing a regional or a city-based digital newspaper and firing it off, you know, on the lines of Bristol 24/7 or something like that. But I mean, if it could be produced in a newspaper looking format, something you could flash off to people's iPads or maybe even their TV screens now, I think probably that's the way the industry is going to go, because the idea of shipping great reams of newsprint to across to people's homes, the economics of it just don't make any sense.
Now, what about back in Manchester? Can you tell us about some either stories that you covered or else incidents at the newspapers where you were working, memorable ones?
Well, too many to name. The Manchester Press had a reputation as a very hard drinking place, and most of the stories usually revolved around drink, unfortunately, so I'd probably rather not go into them. That was one of the reasons why it was a career in the press was generally frowned on by respectable people. I mean, in Manchester there were clubs, I say the word clubs in inverted commas, they were basically drinking dens that were open to members of the press up until 3-4 in the morning. There were so many journos and printers and compositors hanging about at that time that they had to, obviously there was a great need of refreshment, and there were plenty of people who were kept open late in order to satisfy the thirsts of the newspaper workers, which were considerable.
So was this sort of breaks in the middle of the night? People would nip into the down to the club and then back to the paper, or was
That's
it just after
exactly
they finished?
What it was, Tony. Yeah, there were quite a few nippings off to pubs and clubs. In fact, this sounds bizarre, but my father was worked on the press at the Daily Mail, the great rotary presses. And the system there was, because the working conditions were so unpleasant, people were allowed to bring drink into work. They would work half an hour on, and because the noise and conditions and the heat and that were so awful, they were then allowed to repair to the table in the press room and sink a couple of pints and then go back onto the press. I mean, to our minds, this just sounds ludicrous. It's so dangerous. Because by the end of the night, you've got people rolling round these press rooms with these great things thundering away, and they're half cut. But this was the way people behaved in those days. And a great deal of drink, it was normal to consume a great deal of drink, and it wasn't regarded as anything particularly unusual. Of course, drink was fairly cheap.
Now, what about stories that you worked on? Can you ever remember anything which was really quite exciting, got you going as a sub? You know, because obviously you've got deadlines, and you are one of the key people in the paper getting out.
I should explain that I became at a fairly early stage the deputy editor of the Guardian Weekly. So it was the Guardian Weekly was basically a cut-down version of the best stories that were in The Guardian, and it was assembled once a week and it was distributed worldwide. I mean, I remember one night, when just before press, when this wasn't in the daily paper, and I remember Argentina invaded the Falkland Islands, and we were fairly pushed to get that paper out at that time. with the invasion of the Falkland Islands on the front page. That did take some fairly speedy subbing. I can remember that.
Now, in those days, of course, it was the whole thing was actually you included this thing called stop press. I can remember seeing, you know, there was actually a blank bit left on the newspaper, yeah, so that the presses could actually, if there's a really important story came along, presses could be halted.
This was
and a new story added in that section.
Yeah, that there was even a method where you didn't even stop the press, and it was called the fudge box. The fudge box was a slot at the edge of the page one, where you could actually put stories in, like late racing results or football results or some snippet of, you know, some court case, and it was actually bolted onto this part of the press while the thing was running. It sounds lethal, but it was actually, and you didn't actually have to stop the press, and you could take this news mid-run. It sounds bizarre, but it was a feature of press in those days. Particularly the more popular papers would run with a fudge box and take these late stories while the press was actually running.
Now, you mentioned briefly the Union. Do you think there's really any point in being part of the National Union of Journalists or another journalism union as a journalist?
I'm still paying my subs, so I must think there's a point to it. I've paid them for long enough. Yes, I do. I think it's great to have. There's a representative body of people in the trade or profession, and it's a way of keeping people in touch, people of my age, with keeping in touch with younger people. So you need a body that will represent your interests, but in the workplace, in the sphere of pay and conditions, and also as in the sphere of professional standards. So yes, I mean, you know, I'm sure the National Union of Journalists will continue long into the future. It doesn't mean to say I agree with everything it does, but I think overall, more power to its elbow.
Has it actually made a difference in your career at all, the Union?
It certainly did when I started, because for a while I was Father of the Chapel. Presumably people will know what Father of the Chapel is, or Mother of the Chapel.
It's a sort of shop steward, is it?
It's a shop steward. The chapel is a newspaper meeting, workplace meetings were known as chapels from the days of the Methodist chapels, and it had certain religious overtones. When I was Father of the Chapel in Stockport, we negotiated the first house agreement in with the Thompson Group, and that brought us a decent increase in salaries at that time. And then when I joined the Guardian, the Guardian Chapel in Manchester was very active, and I remember going on strike there once for the same paying conditions of we wanted parity with the Manchester Evening News. Can you imagine that? They were better paid than we were. Having said that, the compositors and the press people in those days were paid far more than journalists, because they were better organised.
So have you noticed much of a difference over the years between different newspaper groups and how it is for the Union to deal with the different newspaper groups and how they treat their workers?
Well, quite a few newspaper groups these days seem to completely ignore them. My experience latterly has been with the Northcliffe Group, which was only dragged kicking and screaming into recognition of the NUJ in Bristol, at its Bristol office, about how long ago? About, was it 5 years ago? Yeah, so about 5 years ago when we achieved that. And certainly when redundancy became a big issue, it was extremely useful to have the backing of NUJ people, and the people who came to help us from the London office were of pretty high quality and knew what they were talking about. I mean, that was useful. You don't feel so alone then. I felt that was very well worthwhile.
And now, finally, have you got any advice for young people thinking of entering the profession today?
Oh, dear me. I certainly don't envy the task they have, because it's far more difficult to get in. And because of the immense amount of competition, the salaries are, generally speaking, extremely poor. I mean, the salaries that people were being taken on for at the Northcliffe in Bristol were more or less identical to what they were paying 20 years before. So I suppose if I had any advice, it would be keep in touch with the changes in the media world, and make sure that you stay abreast of the changes, which seem to be coming faster and faster. And good luck to you. I mean, I've had an interesting and rewarding career. I doubt today I'd even be considered for a job in the media. But such are the changing times that confront us.
Okay, Mike, thanks very much.
A pleasure, Tony.